Hey, today I'm here with Tanya Stevenson. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Tanya. Probably best known for your appearances on Channel 4, but now you're the chief executive of the Horse Race Sponsors Association. Yeah. Is that your main thing these days?
One of many. No, it's not a main thing, but it's a really exciting opportunity, especially going forward with everything that racing seems to be struggling with. Because I will go on to it a little bit later, because I stepped out of racing for a while, I've had the opportunity to look back into the sport, and I've stepped back out of racing in a totally different industry as well. So seeing it through the different industry's eyes and how where racing fits on that scale. So then coming back in to be asked to do horse race sponsors, you've got all these exciting ideas, you know how technology, social media platforms like that, computer technology, and the lack of racing's knowledge on how to pitch. I mean, sort of show their positives, data-wise, pairs of eyes, digital footprint, and you know the amount of people coming through the door, and the opportunity of what can get bigger. Rather than what racing has got a really bad habit of, is festering of it on its negativity. Just loves getting embroiled and knotted up in its negativity. And when that's happening, anyone that's looking in is looking in and seeing, oh my goodness me, I don't want to be involved in something that's so negative. So racing should sort of, which it never will do, because but it should focus more on its positivity. And this opportunity hopefully won't have me bang my head against a wall. Well, hopefully bring some new ideas.
Is it challenging these days to get some firms into sponsorship because of the sort of negativity about gambling, etc., that's happening at the moment?
Yeah, it's totally, it's very tricky, very difficult indeed, and racing has to be aware of that, not just gambling, but other issues such as welfare. But at the moment, gambling is the tricky one, because for so many years, and understandably, and it's through tradition, that and it is the sole thing, racing and gambling are married. There's no other way to look at it, but it's the opportunity to bring other entities into racing. You don't just have to focus on the races itself, you can focus on the people, the fashion, and the catering. You can focus on that. You don't have to labour on sponsorship. Start with the small basic things, and then things will grow out of that, other sponsors. But racing sort of just sits on its hands the whole time. It doesn't look to the big picture like retention. It's got not a clue how to do retention. It signs 5-year, 10-year deals, but outside of that, it doesn't look for worst case scenarios, and then also doesn't look for ideal partnerships. There's plenty there.
Okay, now you talk about gambling. You were raised in bookmaking.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've come into the sport via the evil world of gambling.
Oh, it's a beautiful world.
Can you tell us a bit about your beginnings in that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been known nothing else, because as a small child and a pram, I sat in the South End Greyhound track when that was open. That was many years ago when that was open. My mother was a greyhound parader for a couple of trainers who would certainly have some interest to the stewards in this day and age. But they were great trainers, and she used to parade them. There was no babysitters for me. I used to sit in the paddock in my pram, and the paraders that weren't working would look after me, vice versa. And then, of course, Dad was an on-course bookmaker at Southend, so there you go. And then Mother moved from the parade into racing office at Southend. But my academic kind of education was nothing to do with, like, learning Shakespeare. It was tic-tac and clerking and maths, and I was pretty poor at English initially, because it was all about tic-tac and stuff, and worldly wise, and the people that I used to knock about with, they used to go on holiday quite a few times, but they were great fun. That was great characters.
Tell us a bit about some of the characters, because it's a very colourful world, especially back in those days.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether many people know of Roger Barton, who bets at Romford. At those days, he bet at Southend as well. We used to go to Romford too, so you got this little clique, and Rog was great, and then Dad and Rog and Tony Gardner, we all grouped up to work pitches all around the north, like York and Aintree and Chester, and I used to be the clerk, and so there was some great, there was some great comments and great characters involved in that, because Roger was fearless, like a fearless kind of, not as much as Freddie Williams, but was renowned to be fearless in those days. And those that may or may not know, my father is very introvert. He's not like Roger's animated, and he'll heckle and give it some voice. Dad will go along the way, and as long as his opinion's strong. And so I've learned through that. And then by the age of 12, I was pricing up tissues for South in Dogs and Maidstone, as it were, which was a flap. And we went to Ipswich, and there was other tracks, Ramsgate, Canterbury. I stood up at Sittingbourne because they had clashing meetings. I stood up at Sittingbourne and Dad stood up at Canterbury, but he sent me to Sittingbourne thinking, no way would I make it pay. Unfortunately, I did. But we'll get into that a little bit later, because I had, no one knew, but I had dogs with Paul Garland on that occasion. They suspected. But yeah, I mean, I had quite a few dogs with Paul Garland, but my first greyhound though was when we were standing up at Canterbury. But we had some great, great amusement. Another character, pitch next to us at Canterbury, was a gentleman called Kevin, but his clerk was Jeff, and Jeff used to do the betting shop for Kevin, and I used to have my golf bets with Kevin. And I remember one year I backed David Duval to win the Bob Hope Classic. And literally, he needed a miracle score to win it, going into the final round. And we had it on in the stewards' box. They had a Footy Sky Sports were on with Duval. And all I can remember was Jeff going back and up and down the stairs and saying to Kevin, another birdie, Kev. Well done. Another birdie. Shot 59 to win it, Duval. But of course, I weren't the only one on Duval. I was harmless, but the other people. But Jeff was another. He knew I loved my cricket, so I went to. He invited me to Canterbury one day, and I liked McMillan and Richardson, the South African. They come in middle order, those two. Richardson kept the wicket for David. Richardson kept the wicket for South Africa. McMillan was a pinch hitter, and Jeff knew I liked him, so I used to sit on the boundary with Jeff, and he said, you really like these two, don't you? So I said, yeah. So when they went innings halves, Jeff walked right across the pitch into the pavilion. I'm shouting out to him, don't, he come back out with their autographs. That's how much mischief he used to get up to. They used to have a on-site betting at Canterbury as well, and I think they, in that very match, they bet 6-5, something like, 5-6 each of two, South Africa to get 50 in a stupid amount of overs. Of course they would do, because they played Kappa Vessels and Gary Kirsten and obviously McMillan and Richardson, so you knew they meant it. And we weighed into a bit of that, but yeah.
So was this, it sounds like you were just as much of a punter as you were a bookmaker. Was bookmaking ever going to be a full-time career?
Oh, I was a bookmaker. I mean, like, I'm joking aside, but of course you've got to stray off stray off and enjoy yourself. No, I was a serious bookmaker when I was standing up at Sittingbourne, because I used to take the videos home for both Sittingbourne and Canterbury and watch each race 6 times, i.e. each dog, unless a dog got in really bad trouble, watch it more than once and write little record cards. No such thing as computers in them days.
You had your time then.
Had your little record cards. I used to sit up till 1 and 2 in the morning, and then doing a tissue for both tracks with Dad, and of course there were Betamax videos in them days. Betamax, then it went on to VHS. We hadn't even got onto DVDs. We were watching it, we were writing the comments down, and that was a great laugh. And then, because you, although the trainers and owners were 1 or 2 steps ahead, you still got to be not giving too much of a deficit, haven't you? So you had to do the graft. And also I was, the pair of us were stood up in respective pitch one at both venues, and so we priced up first. We had to price up first at both venues. And I have to smile, because when I was at Sittingbourne in pitch one, I have to smile every day, because in pitch two was Ben Keith.
Hope we didn't used to tuck him up.
Ben knows what happens.
So you're totally involved in the bookmaking and the punting. So where did the interest in the media suddenly come from?
There was no interest, to be fair. There was literally no interest, because you say that during the evenings I was pricing up, standing up at the dogs. During the days, 86, I think, SIS came to existence. And come to 1987, I think I did 1 or 2 days due to sickness of their full-time staff. And I literally, meaning 1 or 2 days, I was on the course when someone went ill and I picked the phone up and you were meant to give the betting shows to the betting shops. And I was just the telephonist, so I was writing the shows down and calling them over on a carbon copy. 88, I got a couple more days, which happened to be at Royal Ascot, and I did them. And then 89 onwards, I got more and more days, more and more days. And it was latterly, as we're going to, I think it was about 97, where they were looking for someone, Channel 4, that knew something about betting. And Graham Gould and Derek Thompson come to me, and they said, you know about betting. So I went to apply to Andrew Franklin. He asked me to go to the Cambridgeshire meeting, and I put my headsets on, and the person I spoke to was Mac, which was great. I suppose he was thinking that, I don't know what he was thinking, but he asked me for something in a very sharp, abrupt manner, and I replied in my normal sharp, abrupt manner, which I must admit did end in an expletive, because it's not for, I can't condone it, but of course if you're in dog tracks the whole time, you're standing up on a pitch, and the banter and the heckling, unfortunately that kind of mannerisms doesn't become you, but that's what happened. So of course when he's asked something in an abrupt tone, and then when I answered back in my sharpest waspish voice, we then both burst out laughing, and we hit it off ever since. But prior to that, about a year or so prior to that, Dave Lawrence, who at that time was in charge of Sky Sports and like myself owned greyhounds, asked me whether I'd come along and be a floor manager on Sky Sports Dogs, which I was. I didn't have a clue about TV, but he said, because I own dogs, the kennel hands would know me, so if they didn't want a camera near, so I was the one that was organising the parades. If they didn't want a camera near, they're not scared to tell me where to go, or so that's where that came out as well. So I had the benefit of listening to talk back in two different ways, which was really helpful.
Okay, chat. If I'm not mistaken, I've read the Google properly, 2001 was your on-screen debut for Channel 4 at Haydock, and it all went from there. Was that a lucky break, or was it something you manufactured to work for you?
I didn't want to be on telly. I didn't really care, as long as I could get my bets on and go racing every day. The whole point of me working was the old boy didn't, this is my father, didn't want me sitting around on the sofa. Not that I did that, but he didn't want me like going around and punting here, there and everywhere, which is what I did do, going to dog tracks and getting into all sorts of mischief. So I'd done well. I was Max Runner for four years by then. And unfortunately for racing, it was foot and mouth. So up until March 31st, 2001, which was the Haydock meeting, I was running. For a few weeks I'd been running the yes or no's whether racing should carry on through in foot and mouth, and my seat at Haydock was just behind the set. Well, I could see Tomo aligned with me, and there was a cameras round that way, but not where I was, and I had a little desk laptop printing off the yes or no and other emails as well. And when Tomo or whoever was presenting used to speak to me, I automatically always assumed it was a commercial break, which it was. So when Tomo called over to me on that day and said, what's the percentage of horses, people thinking that horse racing should carry on? I answered that. I didn't have any idea that I was on television. Well, I will say though, the executive producer was on a holiday, so he's not to blame, Andrew Franklin. Who was in charge was Mark Jackson and Jim Ramsey. So when I come off set, they were laughing and chuckling. I still had no idea. No one told me. And they said, oh, what do you think of Skiing Debut? And, you know, I just shrugged my shoulders, because actually the following week was National Week. So there was a thought process of, oh my God, I've got a clerk at Aintree. It was my week off from Channel 4. I've got to go and clerk on a pitch at Aintree. There were, outside of that, I'd appeared on TV. I thought, oh, great gag. Never going on TV again, you know. There was no ambition to be on telly. That weren't me, because I just wanted to go down the dogs that night and have a punt or see whether the golf or cricket was on. Following Aintree, the week after Aintree, Andrew's back from holiday. So we're all called in the office, all three of us, given a good ticking over, mainly because Mark had got 5 commercial breaks in an hour, which at that time wasn't allowed. or was or wasn't allowed. It's just that it was not the done thing, and we always joke now when Mark rings me, I say five commercial breaks in an hour. But you know, he said, "Where's your laptop?" "Where the hell is my laptop? It's in my car." I said, "You better get out. You're sitting next to Simon Holt," because Mac was on holiday at that occasion. And then it dawned on me, "Oh my God, I've got to start." You know, when I didn't know I was on, so I'm on, and I'm thinking, I'm totally confused, and yeah, because you're brought up in betting and bookmaking. I feel it's ethical to be discreet, and so I was fumbling over my words. And in this day and age, because I've luckily gone through and had the privilege of working on TV for so long, I don't give a any more when talking on camera, and I've got that freedom when, thankfully, once again, Dave Lawrence, when I'm, you know, appearing on other things these days.
Now, you mentioned that after telling Mac to go forth and multiply,
yes, right. Yes.
You got on really well with him.
Everybody's
going to miss him, obviously, but you worked very closely with him for a long time. You must have some good Mac stories you can share with us.
Yeah, I mean, what an absolute gent, what a laugh. I mean, people don't realise, they only see the pantomime villain, the man that threw out the quotes to be devil's advocate. We've less include Rod in all of this. People, he didn't get too much mention, did he, with all the tributes? But Rod was part of this team of four. Rod, myself, Jenny and Mac was a team of four. And everyone said how hardworking Mac was, which he was. He used to wheel in this trolley with all these stats in. And when you're working on live TV, you don't realise the urgency of things that need to be. So, of course, some of the comments that are said are sharp and abrupt and may seem to outsiders rude. And Mac would write out his stats on five different race cards, trainers, jockeys, favourites and various things, and he'd layer them up, of which Rod very kindly would keep a couple inside his coat pocket of his fleece. And as they're coming near the line, towards the finishing line, Mac would know what one would be relevant. And I remember this one day when Mac says, you know, in a really sharp voice, "I want Mac now." So Rod's other job was holding the cigar. And he said it in such a tone that Rod went to his inside coat pocket and with the cigar gave the gesture to set light to the specific race card. So when Andrew's calling through to say the comment, we're all bursting laughing. We can't speak because Rod set light to the race card. So that's the kind of playfulness that you get, the kind of kid joking. The other thing that I've mentioned maybe, when Mac used to, well, when Mac, when Leeds were quite high up in the Premier League, as it were, or they were on the periphery of going down, we stood in a donkey's betting ring and Mac looked up to the commentary camera. I'm stood right next to him and he shouted out, "I hope Leeds go down." That wasn't the best idea. That wasn't great either. I mean, he just got in all sorts of mischief. Another one that I loved was the Doncaster press room is a lot different now. The old Doncaster, the press room was on the ground floor and Mac was shouting out for quiet, quiet, quiet. And Frankham saw the old brass band out the front on the tuba and then the trumpet. So Frankham's gone out and given them a backhander to come in because Mac's going, "Quiet, quiet, quiet, I'm trying to do my stats." So Frankham's gone out, give him a whisper, and I'm opposite Mac. I see what was happening, and so could Rod. You see the door opening and the brass band in a whole circuit to the amusement of every pressman in there except for Mac. And then gradually, as they come into the end of their tune, Mac burst out laughing. And then he very kindly, Jenny gave up a ticket every now and then to cricket, because, and then she'd say, "Can you go with Mac to cricket?" And we went to see England Bangladesh one day at Lord's, and Mac was a real sweetie. It was quite a warm day, as you expect, it's the summer of cricket. And Mac, trying to be the gentleman host, went to get us some ice creams. By the time we come back, it's all down his arms. It's dripping down. I mean, yeah, it's just looking at and laughing. And then me and Rod used to like have a little tip up, a little punt with Mac on horses during the day. This'll win, that'll win. And sometimes, because he's so concentrated in all his stats, Rod would go, "Didn't that run well?" I.e., that's gone. Used to kick off. But no, it used to be the whole time, it used to be a complete laugh. But nothing ever with Mac was scripted. She didn't know what was coming. So there'd be so many more memories that I just look back. Oh, that's another one that I love. He used to go on holiday at a specific time to go and do the Breeders' Cup, which used to coincide with me going to see the NFL at Wembley. And he used to say, don't forget to wave to me, female. And I say, there's 90,000 people at Wembley, Mac. How am I going to wave to you? I'll see you. Don't worry, just give us a wave. You imagine he would see you, wouldn't you? You think, oh my God. But no, that's how he was, bless him.
It sounds like you guys were a proper close-knit team, you know, lots of fun. I mean, so what happened with Mac and then what happened to you guys afterwards must have been a real wrench, you know, even more so than what people think.
Yeah, a wrench from, like, losing all your mates, aren't you? Yeah, a wrench from losing all your mates. That's like me, Mac, Rod and Jenny, that little group. That was in 2012. And also the fact that, unfortunately, or fortunately for me, I was selected to do the following 4 years for Channel 4, which then adds a little bit of guilt. I felt really guilty. But the first person on the phone was Mac. First person to congratulate. Don't worry, female. And that shows you just the man himself. He was the first person on the phone, despite all what had gone on and him not going to be alongside me. He was the first on the phone to congratulate me. And then he was always on the phone to me, what's news? Even though he would know more news than me, he'd be on the phone, what's news? Or if my team had beaten his, he'd congratulate me, or vice versa, he'd heckle me. It's good. But no, it is like losing your best mate. It's something that I will never get my head round. And it meant that the next 4 years were like a huge hole in a vacuum. And I know I was in a privileged position, but I didn't enjoy it. I didn't enjoy the next 4 years. And that's really a shame to say. I just kept my head down and was professional, but it wasn't enjoyable. And I tried to make it enjoyable possible. The enjoyable part was going racing all the time and seeing the faces, but you weren't with your best mate and you had this kind of guilt that you should be.
So take with that in mind then, was it, how big a blow was it when you didn't get taken on along with some of your other colleagues to go to ITV? Do you take it as a personal thing?
Well, no, I didn't care a toss. I don't know where I'm at. No, I mean, I'd already... See, that's a really rude and flippant thing to say, but I'd been made redundant more times than they could have been. Redundant, sacked, told to get all the rude words imaginable. I closed down more greyhound tracks you can imagine. I mean, they joke with me that the tracks that I stood up at have closed down. So the bigger blow for me is when Canterbury stood closed down. That was a bigger blow, because I'm a bit mercenary. Because that was things that, like, that was my life. I had loads of little mates there, and loads of little dog training there. Maidstone was a blow, but because of all those blows, when something like missing out on ITV, it's not missing out, is it? They wanted to do something completely new, and because of all that had gone before, had been given the two fingers the whole time. I thought, right, okay, what can we do next? Something will crop up. And sure enough, it did crop up, but not in the way I expected.
Now, you've just reminded me of something that you told me, I think, a while back. You criticised the dog tracks culinary offerings.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us that story.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, oh, bless her, Rachel. Goodness me. I mean, there was... myself and another ground trainer, I'll keep him out of it, but he's so much. I used to write a column in the Racing Post that was meant to be for greyhound racing, and the editor wanted me to be like round the race courses, round the dog tracks and do all the culinary. And I said, unfortunately, at the time, which was unwarranted and unfair, the only thing good to eat at Nottingham was a Mars bar because it was wrapped. That's me. But I'm sorry, Rachel. I'm sorry. And she quite rightly scolded me. And Nottingham is a phenomenal track now, as you saw it. It held the Derby, and once again, it shows you, to Rachel's credit, what a phenomenal person that runs that track now. She got the Derby, she ran it professionally. But at that time, you know, you were put on a microscope and you just didn't want to follow everyone else's pandering to everything. I mean, there was a time at Perry Bar, I had to take Perry Bar to task. Different now, because of whatever, they wouldn't give someone a jacket potato on a burger voucher because they were, you know, that was a long way down. This is how long ago, it's about 20 years ago. 20 years ago. That's how scary it was, in the fact that it was Terry in charge of Nottingham then. I mean, yeah, so that's what I was like. That's me. Which people, unfortunately, TV didn't see me. Because once again, you just keep yourself guarded, don't you?
Okay, Tanya, now, we'll talk about what you're doing now in a bit, but yeah. You're a punter still?
Always a punter, even though drilled in from me from birth was never go to churches. Drilled onto me, and father saying, I always want to be your bookmaker. He ain't wrong, but I am always a punter because it's something I enjoy. And yes, I do understand it's a problem for some people, but for me, it's the buzz, it's self-recognition, it's the enjoyment, it's trying to prove that you're right on something. But yeah, I do enjoy punting.
But you might enjoy punting, but do you make the bookmakers pay you, or do you pay the bookmakers? This is the are you a winner?
I wouldn't tackle me on golf. And I wouldn't tackle me on cricket, but I always tackle me on racing. And yeah, when NFL comes about, I don't dabble so much now in all of them because other interests, because I like to study really hard. Or I don't know whether people remember Golf Weekly. About 25 years ago, there was a golf fantasy competition. I led that like for a few weeks. You know, so I appreciate and respect what Steve Palmer and Jeremy Chapman do because I know how much work they put into it. It's not just writing a column each week. I used to have every publication imaginable even sent over from America to me because I used to focus on the PGA Tour at the time, to the extent that I was refused bets on 101 shots, and, you know, it was really frustrating. So when the exchanges came for my golf punting was a godsend. And also when the exchanges came, it meant that I could hedge out on chokers, because I knew that if I back a choker, I want to get out if he's hit the front, if he's lucky enough to hit the front. I remember back in Chad Campbell for the Honda Classic at 66-1, and after the second round he was 5-2 favourite, and when you saw who was stacking up behind him, no way. I did bottle it and cash out, but Chad Campbell never won that tournament. So it's seeing those opportunities. And I got a lot, I mean, people may never have heard of some golfers. My car was paid for by Matt Every. Just Matt Every. He won the Bay Hill Classic twice. So after the first year, I'd back a few shillings in the first year. Second year, I waded in a second time. My biggest ever win was him winning the Bay Hill. People think that it was Todd Hamilton. I mean, Jeremy Chapman always remembers me and Todd Hamilton in the Open. But subsequently, I never thought it was going to happen like that again, because I remember Todd Hamilton in the Open, I was laying him at evens and Dad was driving. Because, luckily, he saw the situation I was in, he drove and stand up at Sitting Bull for me on the Sunday night. Normally me, I stood up at Sitting Bull, but he drove down and stood up for me while Todd Hamilton was going down the final stretch with Ernie Els. And then when he finally won that tournament, yeah, it was good not going to Sitting Bull.
Right. So I don't want to talk figures, but no. Would you describe your punting as small, medium or large?
Medium. I'd describe it as medium. This week I'm not gonna win on the Open this week, but I'm not going to lose as such. I wade into Cupcake, as I call him, Brooks Koepka. But there's a couple of massive outsiders that are playing well, and I can just jiggle around a bit. But I'm always looking, say, for tournaments for next week and next week and next week. I'm medium.
Right. Getting away from that, but not totally, punting still. You became involved with the Horse Race Betters Forum.
Yeah. A lot of testosterone in that room, wasn't there? Which I'm used to, because like when I was stood up at the dog tracks, I would, other than the trainers and some kennel hands, there weren't many people that would chat back to the testosterone. It means well, and it's been doing a real lot of work, a lot of good work under Matt and Simon, doing a lot of good work, but it's still got to focus on what the whole of racing punters want. And it's done so much hard work on that, but sometimes that gets my feeling, sometimes that gets lost in all of us, and I'm as guilty as anyone.
How do you mean exactly? What things?
Self-interest. You know, and I'm as guilty as anyone because I'm a selfish, but then selfish and independent. And it's very tricky not just to focus on what the people within the room want and then what other people want. But then, as much as that's to blame, those outside of that room should then communicate more with their observations, their criticisms, what they want. There's lack of that. There's too much apathy everywhere. I mean, that doesn't help. But yeah, no, I mean, you've already got a short tenure. And plus, because I was doing my normal thing of getting easily distracted, that's been the same, that I just had to walk away, because otherwise, see, I've got no filter. Not, you didn't see the real me in front of the camera, because you couldn't do, because my filters, to the extent that what I do now, I'm kept in the corner washing up, because if I'm at the till, I'd be there for 5 minutes.
Well, this is an adult channel, so you can be yourself. I mean, so why did you leave in the end?
Why did I leave? Yeah. Just that, because I got no filter, I couldn't control myself, and people around me. But no, why did I leave? I was starting to get other roles. The business sale on our run was starting, other roles, I now work in ITV production. I now part in a business. I now appear in front of camera still. I was doing Weatherby's, writing blogs for Weatherby's at the time. They very sweetly gave me a window to write. So there was so much going on. I couldn't give enough to the Horse Race Bears Forum, and I felt guilty about that, because they are so hands-on. They want you to go and speak in the rings, and I wasn't. This is where I say I stepped out of racing. I wasn't in racing enough to qualify to be on that panel.
And in, as part of that role, and since you've left, you've been taking part in sort of parliamentary sort of discussions and.
Yeah, because I was really kindly asked back on the horse race. Horse Racing Sponsors Association. Part of that was to go and speak to the all-party racing group, i.e., what I thought preached to the converted. But what was really refreshing and really great about that was, the converted weren't in the room. What came is what I needed to see. We'd been hearing from outside of racing, what we'd been hearing from the BHA. What I mean, people, MPs that came into the room weren't part of the all-party racing group, i.e. they knew nothing about racing, or they knew racing was about, but they had their angles and their dislike. So, of course, I went in there thinking that the first question I would be asked would be towards welfare. We're recording on a day when Richard Flint's article came out, and in fact the first questions that were aimed at me was towards gambling and how betting is the not there's plenty of negativity towards betting, and it opened my eyes to how much negativity towards betting there is. And that would maybe suggest that it was just one party's MPs that were coming in, but there were Lords coming in as well. So be warned. And racing be warned. Because as much as those with forthright opinions and beliefs and saying racing should stand up for, and it should stand up for, unfortunately for all of us, we don't go into Parliament. Even if we did go into Parliament, we don't stick our hand up. And if they vote that they don't want us, it's a bit of a pain, isn't it? You know, that's so somehow there is a need to go and translate all our positivity. As I said at the start, we've got to translate our positivity, because quite often, as racing finds and as everyone finds, decisions are made that we can have no bearing on. And the best thing that we could do is find our detractors, transcripts of our detractors, and see how much racing is going to struggle. And it's not just racing, there's every, all industries are going to struggle. The best thing to do is find transcripts, and that's all you have to do, because they're the decision makers in the end.
Yeah, now you work now. you work with ITV again.
I do. I work behind the scenes.
And you're on TalkSport Radio.
Yes.
Do you not miss being in front of the camera?
I am in front of the camera. Thanks to Clive Lawrence and Dave Lawrence, particularly to Clive Lawrence. He risked me last year in front of the camera, for, initially as a guest on Racing Post Greyhound TV. Because I say risk me, and I was a huge risk, because I've been out of greyhound racing for number of years, so the people that I were appearing with were the sons and the daughters of the trainers I had dogs with. So when they were walking in, mum says hello or dad says hello, I'm thinking, oh great. So you can see what a big vacuum hole that I'm missing, but now I've been able to slowly but surely catch up, and from being a guest I'm now hosting, and oh my goodness me, do I have great fun with Tony Bullen. I mean, I think if you watch it, and me and Tony are on, there is utter mischief. Because when the emails come in, Tony's not afraid of reading them out. If they're constructive criticism and they've got a little bit of, I don't know, malice behind them, but in a sensible way, he'll read them out. Because Tony's all his experience of training and my experience of owning, we can then sort of try. I mean, they're not going to listen to us. I mean, someone emailed in the other, this is how mischievous Tony is. Someone emailed in the other day and he read it out, said, Tanya needs to be out in the field more. And Tony replied, said, yeah, we need more scarecrows. That's what Tony's like. He's great. He's absolutely great. I've got him I've got him a few times coming up in the next couple of months. So, but other than that, but as soon as we walk in the production gallery, they say to us, behave. I remember him reading an email out about handicaps or something, handicap dog racing, where the traps go up and that's it. I mean, he read out a record amount of emails because he's so contentious. And that's what you need. You cannot have a sterile environment. That's why you need, you know, you need a Tony, you need a Matt on ITV, because if you don't have them, it's boring. It is so, so boring.
Right, what's not, probably not boring. Mm. You, we're all about shameless promotion here. Show us your logo.
Oh, God,
and run
yeah.
a coffee shop.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't you find the time to do all this stuff?
Everyone says that to me. I don't know. They say give more work to a busy person, don't they? Yeah, as I said, when when Channel 4 came to a close, which was December 2016, at that point, as it was coming to a close, we saw nearby where we lived, there was this building with whitewashed windows. It used to be a tea shop. This is me and my father. And I'd also done a learn how to make coffee course and how to run a coffee shop course, but that was just totally independent. I had no intention. I didn't know what he was going to do. So we got the lease, but in order to get the lease, you need to speak to the landlord, and then ended up buying the whole building. So now I run a coffee shop with him, and before I come to see you today, this is what I mean, I was by the dishwasher and washing up bowl, because I have to have my back, because I have back chat, so I'm washing up the whole time. I was so manic. Today there was lots of lattes and lots of smoothies today, but everyone was sheltering from the weather. But I don't know, it's just the buzz, isn't it? Because they would say that, and you'd say that quite many years ago when I was in my teens, when I was watching all those dog videos, like you was working for SIS, watching the dog videos, coming home, you'd say, my only know-how to exist is a work ethic, and just work, work, work the whole time. And that may be to the detriment of everything else. I.e. people would say a social life, but my social life has been punting, so social life has been, messing about and punting.
Now, when I was stalking you, or should I say researching?
Yeah, stalking,
I did see on one of your social media pages the phrase, never say if only. What's all that about?
What's all that about? That's because I'm so independent in life and I want to do everything I can, but of course you never, no one do anything beyond their means. don't bet beyond your means, don't do anything beyond your means. But me, I love my sport, so I want to go and see things. So never say if only means say I want to see, unfortunately I'm a gunner, everyone, I can't help that. I want to see Arsenal Liverpool, but of course when other people go to the football, I get the other matches, not the marquee matches of the Emirates Stadium. So I bought at auction Arsenal to be Liverpool, so I'm finally going to see it. And then what I mean by never say if only, there was, I think it was about 2009 where the T20 World Cup was here. Dad and I bought tickets to every game. We went to see every game. We took the whole of June. That was amusing. That was amusing trying to tell Andrew Franklin that wouldn't be working in June. Instead, I was watching like South Africa, New Zealand and every cricket match. The same said that ordinarily I'd be at the Open this week, but other outside things have contrived that I can't be there. But there is a reality is that Sandwich next year and I'll be at that. Don't worry about that. That's just, to me, that's round the corner. And yeah, that's the kind of thing. So never say if only. So Dad said never own dogs. I had 20 in the end. And then, you know, that story early doors when I mentioned about Jeff going to get the autographs for the cricketers. I ended up in recently being a volunteer at the ICC Trophy. So never saying if only, do the things that you want to do beyond, you know, within your means. That's what I say. Just enjoy life. So never say if only. I've been very lucky.
Brilliant. Tanya Stevenson, thank you very much.
Download the Star Sports app from the App Store or Google Play. All of the Star Sports markets, including in-play, all easily accessible from your phone or tablet. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.